Okay,
so
well,
anyway,
I was just mentioning that I think Dave Heeshan and his management style were, in fact, a very important part of this. To my mind, this instrument is Dave Heeshan's memorial. Not that he needs a memorial yet, but it's worth more than a pile of marble somewhere.
Yeah.
Another person that seems to have been largely forgotten, and it's too bad, is George Swenson. George was hired away from the University of Illinois by Dave. Dave had gone to the University of Illinois, knew George there. And George was the son of a very fine electrical engineer and was himself a professor of electrical engineering. And George, have you ever met him?
I have not.
No, you have. He's a big guy. He's about 6'4". He has a slow and ponderous manner, which, to the imperceptive, looks like he ain't very bright. Well, that's the wrong impression.
It's a ruse.
He has it. So, he's just a big bear of a man. But George was hired to be the leader of the design group. His job was to run that design group. The rest of us were trying to do some science along with it. And, boy, who was on that? Heeshan and George Swenson. I don't remember now if the eight includes those two or not. But there was, of course, Barry Clark, who was well in the system by then, Dave Hogg, Sandy Weinreb. I'm probably going too fast. Warren Tyler. Myself, and a Chinese graduate student named Leonard
Chow,
who made a huge contribution, even missed Barry.
But he was
the Y-shaped.
He was a graduate.
I believe he was finishing his thesis, but working out of one of the universities in Canada, and. Right, I've named six in addition to the first two. Must have been some others, and those they can be looked up.
Yeah, and I have eight if you include Heeshan and Swenson.
Right. I've always thought of it as initially eight, then other people came and went. We all had different things to do. Not surprisingly, Barry Clark played a vital role on computer stuff. Though Warren Tyler and I were much involved in that in the beginning, what we were trying to do was avoid having this group, a collection of prima donna experts, each one of whom was expert on something no one else knew. When it came to writing a proposal, George had us write, we'd draft chapters, different, but then they'd be finished off by someone else, things like that. And it was good because all sorts of the mental inbreeding we get when we work on something too hard had a chance of being shown for what it was and corrected. Well, that was later when we had the first design. My own involvement was on two very different things. One was to find the site for this thing. After all, something like that, the site is in fact an integral part of the instrument because it will determine the limitations that you have to deal with at home in order to get at the sky. And so there's a long saga on that. I got to eat in lots of bad backwoods restaurants, for example, all that. My first trip out here with Sidney Smith, who had already gone over the maps and found possible sites, a great number of them, back when we thought a 10-second array would still do it. We came out in November of 1965, and we arrived in the old Albuquerque airport terminal. When we left a week later, they were in the new one, which is the first version of the present one, so that dates it right there. The first site we looked at, in fact, turns out to be the one we wound up with. we had to come up with a new list, and Sydney actually came up with a list of about 14 that were wise with 15-mile arms. It was later, with understanding how to use the data better, we could shrink them down to 13. And there, Mary Clark somehow showed up, you know. Anyway, this all happened about the time that Mother Chow pointed out that we could do better if we used a Y shape instead of a T shape on the antennas. So that Y shape was built into that first list of large antenna sites. I got into it, and then Sid sort of moved out to other things. Basically an engineer and mechanical engineer. And it was largely all me to find the site, and we eventually considered 34, many of which could be rejected quite quickly. Some of them were in the list for political reasons. Lyndon Johnson was president then, so we had to have a site in Texas in there. Actually, one of those did make it to the final list, under Marfa. Blah, blah, blah. The other thing I was doing was sort of the thermodynamics. We had been talking loosely about 25-meter dishes because they were the controllable size and all that, but would it really do the job? So I wrote the chapter on antenna size and sort of made it look like we had come to that size from knowing the requirements, the scientific requirements of the array. In all honesty, we knew the answer and then we went to find the questions. But it was that was the other thing I did. So two very different activities. So thermodynamics versus tromping around the compass.
So how many sites did you end up actually physically going to?
Probably about 20. Well, 20s, I can't remember now. I don't, again, don't have the notes. But, spring of 1965. Charleston, West Virginia. This Swedish or Finnish Forester's compass.
Wow.
$15 it cost then. There's now about 120. It's very accurate. You can work to a fraction of a degree with that little sighting thing there. I, through some swindle, got hold of some Luftwaffe World War II aircraft paint, which adheres to aluminum. Because that thing, the glare of the sun off of that thing can affect taking readings in the daylight. That's what I used to check out all the LA sites. My own equipment. A major investment of $15. It's an excellent piece of equipment. So I'm very proud of it. But I used that thing to lay out the VLA up here. The initial layout, and then of course when we really got going, the surveyors came in and did it right, but I could get close. But yeah, that's one link with the time and the effort right there, because that was always on my belt. This isn't the original case. So anyway, much involved in that, and am I rambling too much?
No, you're doing fine.
Other people were doing their things. Sandy Weinreb and Warren Tyler, who had absolutely no use for each other, worked together very well getting the electronics roughed out initially, for example. I liked them both. But they did have great slabs of pure prima donna in them. So, you worked hard, and you know one thing that, all right, context here, hadn't really dawned on me until September of last year. George Swenson's 80th birthday was being celebrated in Urbana. Last time I made a stand-up talk in front of a bunch of people. George, Dave Heeshan was there, and I was there. And Barry Clark was there, George, let's see, Dave Falk, Barry just was in the audience. He, basically, he's getting his feet down again from losing Betty and all that. But the Barry always improves the quality of people in the room he's in, on average. And so it's good. I got to talking to Dave the evening before, and you know, Dave, have you ever thought about how young we were when we did that? Look at what they're doing now, extending VLA, depending on people in their 50s, all that. Barry Clark was, I think, 27 or something when that started in that. Dave himself was maybe 38 or so when he got going with it. Not even 40 yet. Remember, in a mature organization like you've got down there, anybody that young is probably not regarded as capable of tying his own shoes. Dave was the old man in the project. George Swenson was something like 42 or something. I'm 73 right now. That seems juvenile, right? Remember, I retired and my age caught up with my IQ. Well, the whole thing, most of us were in our 30s. Now, I would have been 34 when I made that first site trip out here. But we were all young. And looking back on it, I think that in various ways that might not easily be particularized, our very youth, combined with the total dedication we all had to what we were trying to do, led to a very superior result, and it's sitting right out there on the plains of San Augustine right now. It was a real privilege to have been a part of it. And you look back at George Swenson, who's got to be given his due. So many people, I think, have never heard of him now. But I think Dave Heeshan and George Swenson were the, what do you call it, the magicians who made it happen. They combined, they kept us all on track. Never mind, Joe, that's a cute idea. However, we're working on the VLA right now. This kind of thing. George, I thought, handled his work superbly, and I did not have the wit at the time to appreciate how well he was doing it. But since then, as I have matured a bit, perhaps, I have come to appreciate him much more. It was a funny situation because, except maybe in a few areas where he was particularly knowledgeable, he did not know as much about the various components of this thing he was coordinating as the individuals working on it. But what he did do was appreciate, understand what was going on, and could see the holes. Or he could see where too much work was doing. You know, you've got to keep the thing advancing on something like a straight line. If you get too many spikes into enemy territory, they may not work. And, or the spikes going the other direction. And George did a superb job of coordinating that, pointing out the things that we were missing in our enthusiasm for our own little empires in this thing. And it's just a, well, he deserves an A. Those of us who remember him and know what he was like to work with, I think have all come to appreciate him very much. I think a lot of the younger people around have either not heard of him at all or have heard of him in a way that builds no appreciation. But I think people would agree with me that he performed a vital function.
How long was he with the project?
Okay, this I'll get ahead of myself a bit. He came, I think, about the fall term 1965 when the organized project took form. And he was the, I forget his exact title, but he headed the design group and so on. He stuck around. All right, let's see, another date here. We had the first two volumes of the proposal to NSF finished in January of 1967. And convulsive effort, there were heroic efforts of other people. I remember Peggy Weems, who was our technical illustrator. She didn't want to be called a draftsman then. She's been gone a good many years. But she, this was before he had computers to draw the stuff with, and she did a heroic job of preparing illustrations and doing it well. And Phyllis Jackson, did you know her at all? She was the director's secretary for many years. Phyllis is one of my favorite people. I hugely respect her. She did all the typing, in addition to being director's secretary. And that's really capable. One of the things that I admire about Phyllis, her name's worth remembering too, Dorian. She was from Arlington, West Virginia. And I remember when I was living in Green Bay, she came on the payroll. And she was not great. But she learned. And long before I left Charlottesville, I felt she was the best secretary I'd ever seen anywhere. And she deserves credit for that. You can't put it in something you're writing, but you know, she was another hillbilly girl who just, she found a job at the astronomy, as they called it over there then. But some spark got hit, and how she grew. And I kid you not, I still almost regard her as the greatest secretary I've ever known. She's so capable. And it's so nice to see something like that happen with people. And so she's retired now. Oh, gosh. This actually is germane to the question you asked about how long George was around. The first proposal was pretty much a casualty of the Vietnam War. And it could have died, except too many of us believed in it too much, and we refused to put it aside. So more work was done, made things a lot better. It went from a 36-element array to a 27-element array, things like that. The arm length went from 15 miles down to 13, all because we understood better how to do it. The electronic design was much improved. Because now you had time. It was a rush before. Barry Clark had some brilliant insights into how to handle the data that hadn't surfaced yet. So the time was not wasted. And volume 3 of the proposal, which now updated the first two volumes, was submitted in 1969. George left in there. I would not trust my memory on dates exactly here. George had seen us through heroically that period from, well, it was only a year and a half. Boy, it seemed longer. It was, say, the middle of 65 till early 67. He stuck around probably another year with this effort of trying to keep things improved, but he was terribly discouraged. And I know he thought it would never be built. And sometime there, I imagine it must have been about 68, George walked in my office there in Charlottesville, sort of bemused look on his face. Sort of a half smile. You know, Dave just fired me.
Oh.
But it says something about both those guys that remain friends.
Mm-hmm.
But Dave fired him because he didn't want someone in charge of the project who didn't know he was going to go. He more or less took over that role himself then. So George went back to the University of Illinois and resumed his professorship. Probably not many people know that when you get there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it tells you something about those two fellows as men. They could do that. There's still a lot of respect there. But Dave was absolutely hard-nosed, and he really felt that George was not benefiting the project anymore, not in way. And I know he thoroughly admired him.
Now, you said your office was in Charlottesville?
At that time, I went to Charlottesville at the end of 65. Actually, I moved my family over there in summer of 65, but the building, Stone Hall, did you know that building, Stone Hall?
No.
It was being built then, okay. It was moved into in December, I think, just basically the end of the year. And then on that was their place, and my office was upstairs. You know your way around the building there. You get to the head of the stairs and you walk. Head down to the left. First thing you pass on the left is the men's room.
Mm-hmm.
Next office was Dave Hogg's. Mine was the next one after that. So that was my office. I forget the number on it now. I still remember my office number in Green Bank. That was 304. No, it was 208. That's right. Yeah, I think my office was 304 in Charlottesville. I remember numbers forever, but I forget names in a minute. Yeah, my phone extension, Green Bank, was 105-314. Yeah, that was it. Yeah, it was 208 was my office there. Not that that's any relevance here. So, anyhow, that's where they were. George walked in. He was gone fairly soon after that. I think he was gone before that third volume was done. And if my recollection serves, there was no real successor to George appointed. I think Dave more or less took it over himself. And I wrote the fourth volume of the proposal. I don't have a copy of it.
That's
the one on the site work.
Right.
Basically, it doesn't have my name in it either, but the first chapter I did write all of. It described the work to get the site list and the recommendations. Then the main thickness of the volume was made up of reports from Limbaugh Engineers, which no longer exists under that name, in Albuquerque. L-I-M-B-A-U-G-H. And they're a pretty good bunch. With our involvement, meaning my involvement, we chose seven sites that looked like they at least would be workable for the array. I was much closer to this thing than anyone else. I was the only person that actually walked all these things, been there and flown them and all that. So I knew them about as well as anyone from Charlottesville would know them. And we took the sites that looked like they could be made to work with the array and then tried to give them an absolutely objective evaluation. This is why you needed Limbaugh, because by then I was convinced the Plains of San Augustine was much the best spot. In fact, in a way it was good. So hunting through all these sites and having seen that one first, that gave me a standard of comparison for all the others that came later, and that was awfully valuable in focusing your attention. And then comes all the committee discussions, and people, how do you know this is the best possible site? Well, you don't know it. There's no such thing as the best possible site. We're not looking for the best possible site. We're looking for a site that will work well. See, that is an attainable objective. The best possible site is a metaphysical concept. It depends on who's defining best, for example. It depends on the stage of the instrument. It depends on a lot of things that you can't tie down. But you can be pretty sure that something will work. And that's what we went for. But sort of thing of having a straw man. Okay, these arguments time and again, I got tired of it. Okay, you don't like this here, but I can see why you're concerned about it. What would you say is a better choice? almost never got an answer. But, you know, intellectuals tend to get their mouths going. It gives them a chance to rest their brains. And I know now, with myself, I'd have been much smarter to be an engineer, because I don't really have this purist-type view that a good science really needs. I do science, but I always sort of wanted to see things built and working. And that's an engineer's mindset. Another thing that didn't help was my politics tend to be considerably more conservative than most of the intellectuals. I'm the only one with a blue-collar background on this. Blue-collars do tend to be conservative. And it stuck. Well, anyway, I ramble. Old man talking here.
So you were with Limbaugh, and you came down to seven?
We came down to seven sites, and we contracted with them to evaluate them in depth. And this included things like analyzing what the array would do to the drainage in the area, that level of detail. What is the groundwater like? Can we drink it? Will it take a drain field from the septic system? Is the ground stable enough that the antennas won't hold? But because we knew by then that we needed them to stay steady to a fraction of a millimeter, we were to hold a good calibration. You look at them, they're so huge, but in fact, they are precision instruments. In terms of the overall size of those antennas, they're much more precise than any watch that anyone made. Not surprising if you think about it, it seems odd when you first hear it.
Sure.
And away it went.
So who made the final decision?
Okay, I'll come to that in just a minute. We got the report back from Limbaugh, and it was 1970, so a large part of 1970, putting all this together into the volume, and I wrote that lead chapter in it. It even listed the most important site trips. And, there were other smaller ones, but these were actually critical to helping the list evolve. And I haven't seen it since I left Charlottesville, because I don't have a copy, so they hooked it.
There's one in the library here. There's one in the library here.
Is there? Don't tell anyone. Well, I ought to go look at it sometime. Well, anyway, at this time people were very worried about the politicians getting into the act, and with reason. The Argonne National Lab in Chicago, that was decided by the politicians, not by the Department of the Instrument, and the people at AUI were well aware of this history. So I was under strict orders not to talk to people about any of this. Doing it within the group, yes. And basically the word didn't get out, though this will lead to another thing that perhaps should go in. But let's answer your original question first. By the end of 71, I believe, something like that, I had that thing finished. It was even printed, and Phyllis had done her typing and all that. And Jerry Tape was in the president of the AUI, strict orders. We just sit on that. Wouldn't go anywhere. No circulation, volumes, nothing.
So AUI was the.
They were very much involved at this point.
And they were the people who were saying, don't talk to anybody about this.
But they were right, because see, these were experts from all over.
Right.
And they had an awareness of some of the political realities that few of us would have been exposed to. And I think it was a beneficial system. And it worked well. I've always had a lot of respect for the AUI board there. We've had an occasional one in there who perhaps would have done better elsewhere. But on the whole, for a group of that nature, I think remarkably, they're way better than our board was. Their feet, for example, in my opinion. And very selfless group. They're capable. Well, it was the State of the Union message, and the President budget message, in January of 72, that the VLA project actually went public. And it's quite a day to remember for me, because I sat in my son's hospital room and listened to Nixon, whom I detested, giving all this stuff while he was down the hall getting bone marrow taken out. I'm sure he had leukemia. And there went a lot of my attention the next 3 years, that's how long it took. But that day in January of 72, that's one I'd not care to repeat. Well, I remember Dave Heeshan's comment. We wanted this thing so long, and now we're getting it from a crook. This was before Watergate. It was later that same year that the Watergate thing came out. But anyhow...
Well, was it mentioned in his State of the Union?
It was not in the State of the Union, but with the State of the Union, coincident in time. And I recall some of the commentary, you know, after this was talking about the budget message, which did include it. And honestly, right now, especially given the stress of the day, I don't recall just what I heard when. But it was a package in our mind, because it was at that time we knew that the VLA now had White House endorsement. It was proposed to the, it went to the budget by the NSF, of course, not directly from us. So at that time, this thing went out, and by then we had flogged through things internally and wanted the planes to San Augustine, and that was a single-handed argument on my part, I think. I felt it was, anyway. A lot of people, including some pretty respectable ones, were heavily in favor of putting it on the Papago land out west of Tucson. Well, it would have spilled over into private farmland, but about two-thirds had been in the Papago land. Why? They thought it should be near a big city. And here's where some stuff comes in. Most of these people had city background. I grew up on a remote farm in Kentucky. I hate big cities. So it's... And this prejudice affected everybody. I think even people who weren't aware they had such a prejudice was there. But one thing that helped with that one, I found a report put out by the Weather Bureau. I would make contacts all sorts of places, really valuable. You'd learn stuff that you'd never pick up just walking to the library. And one guy in the Weather Bureau in Tucson, yeah, I was always talking to Weather Bureau people. That was really part of the site work. He gave me a copy of a report called Desert Flood. And I forget exactly when it was, but it was sometime in the 60s, so it was recent at that stage. There had been a major monsoon rainstorm out there, which had actually flooded over half the area where we would put the array if it had gone there. And a few years later, actually it was right in that time frame, I went out to do some observing to get peaked. And I had to turn around at 3 points there because Brawley Wash had taken out the bridge. And I remember standing there in the light. It was terrifying. I was riveted. Enormous trees coming down this thing. Where did those trees come from? That part of it. But there they were. It was a violent thing. And it was something similar to that that this report was about. And they reported that the Weather Bureau has these people reading thermometers and reading gauges all over. And one rancher in there, I said, couldn't tell if there's much rain. Gauge washed away. So they just printed it down there verbatim. But that sort of killed it. And there, it would have been horrible in there, walking around in there. Never really saw them in the daytime. Have you ever seen Sidewinder tracks or sort of discontinuous interlocking arcs? They're all over out there. If we had sent technicians out, no, I did not like that. And the heat. And don't know. So it wouldn't have worked, but I've said enough about that, I think. But still, the we had this kind of thing worried about. The only serious contender for PLA, ultimately, I think, was Tucson. But if you put those two together, there's no comparison. There are some others that would have given the PLA a harder run for its money. But there, they happen to be places where the logistics have been much tougher than here. The VLA was the second highest site in the total list, and I don't think Y4, which is at 7,400 feet, actually made the final list. Yeah, in fact, I know it didn't. When we flew over it, we could see recent fault lines. You know, they're still steep. After they've been out there a few hundred years, they're like this. And you never see that if you're on narrow the ground.
That was where?
Okay, you know where Grants is. Mm-hmm. The Grants lava flow there, which mm-hmm. probably is very late prehistoric, because people could remember it when Coronado came in. Well, one of them, there are many stages of the flow. On to, well, to the south, I think it's New Mexico 17, goes on down toward El Moro.
Right.
Y4 was down in the end. There's an area called North Plains, which on the map looked like it was serviceable. And it would have been a little bit tight. You see, one thing about the Plains of San Augustine is most of the other possible sites did not offer. It was potential for expansion down the arms. And there would have been none of that of it. I know it's number Y4. PLA's at Y15. Those designations aren't used anymore, of course. It flew over it, looked at it very carefully, and see the steps in the ground. There are obvious fault scarps. What had happened, there's still settlement taking place from this volcanic activity, which geologically was extremely recent. So you would have had a moving array had we gone in there. And for 400 feet extra elevation, it wasn't worth it. The PLA site actually is a very workable place. And there are odd things about it, which we knew about, but we knew how to take care of it. For example, that lake bottom sediment is full of morellonite clay, which has the lovely property of expanding enormously when it gets wet. And then when it dries out, it doesn't go back, it's just all fluffy. And so the way we beat that, of course, was to ballast all the road works and to put down deep, carefully designed foundations. And every foundation is individually designed because the soil profiles do it, that kind of thing. And it's worked pretty well. We did find some that were moving a bit, but not too much. So, yes, I've rambled off very far here. Before 1972 started, though, I think there was general agreement that the Plains of San Augustine was the best place. From my own standpoint, I'm very happy that I never changed my mind after we were committed to it. That would have been a little hard to take. I still think it was the best place. But we sort of worked hard at it in order to get to that conclusion. Well, Jerry Tate then let us go public with this. April of 1972. Now the project was going to take form in a visible way to everybody. Should I keep talking about this, or are you worn out?
No, okay. I'm fascinated.
Okay. I know I'm missing a lot too, but
I know your phone number.
Uh-oh. Well, let's see. We knew early on that there's likely to be a lot of opposition to this thing. Ranchers, I admire. I come from that kind of background myself. But they don't like change. They work very hard to get what they've got. And despite a lot of city prejudices, they are some of the most intelligent people I've ever known. They don't survive by being stupid. They may be rough, they may cuss, they may use funny grammar, some of them, but most of them are better educated than you might think. And most of them are very well read. What do you do out in the middle on a long winter evening? They read. And so, anyhow, this is a place now where my own rural background turned out to be very important, because I was at home with people like that. Somebody from Long Island would not have been. And, okay, it was April of 1972. Victor Bremenkamp, who was then sort of the assistant, I forget his exact title, but have you heard of him? He retired about the time I did. He was sort of the super gopher at AUI headquarters in Washington. He did an awful lot of the organization when there were meetings. He'd see to the details, etc. He was pretty good at that. He had a degree in mathematics, I think, which he never used. He'd also been a cross-country truck driver. He had a rather wide background. And sort of fun. He was a very liberal Democrat. And I was a Democrat, too, but of the more southern variety, I guess. More conservative. So it was fun to have discussions at times on these long trips that we did to those places together. We had to go public. This got into the papers. There was a lot of unhelpful speculation in the community because of the vacuum that was there. There wasn't anybody there to answer the questions. So there was trouble brewing. And Vic and I came out. The purpose of taking our lives in our hands and going and talking to the people who are going to be affected with this. And we walked into a hornet's nest. I don't recall now whether we went to Santa Fe first or we went there afterwards. I think we made two trips back to back. I can't really recall it now. I think we went to Santa Fe first. At that time, Bruce Keene was in his first term as governor. And do you know of David King, nephew of Bruce King? David King was nephew of the governor and just graduated from college at about 22 or something. And he was head of the State Development Commission, or whatever they called it, I forget what it was. Green behind the ears, full of his own importance, and without any qualifications as far as I can tell. In fact, he was known over the state as the man from Uncle. It was called the TV program.
That I remember.
Yes, okay. Well, we, Vic Bremenkamp and I, from representing AUI, and Maury Safer and Jerry Anderson from NSF. Not Maury Safer, you know. Oh, what's his name? Phillips. Maury Phillips. Maury Safer's a journalist.
I thought so.
Yeah. Maury Phillips came out. It was going to be their meeting. NSF was going to go to it. And you don't have to write all this down. I'm not looking. It's a place where I got very involved and probably made a considerable difference since I know something about it. We stayed at La Fonda and up in Santa Fe. And Jerry told us how it was going to be. He's the man from NSF. And Jerry's a great glad-hander, very pleasant fellow, and all that. And he said, all right, we're going to get together for breakfast, and we're going to go over how we handle these characters. You know. He obviously didn't think much of the locals. Our meeting was scheduled with David King. And boy, he really laid it on strong. I mean, he and Maury Phillips, we were going to handle it. And basically, Vic and I were there to back him up with technical information. Well, it's not the way it worked. It was in the Roundhouse, the state capitol. The only time I've ever been there. David King, having read various books, knew how to handle people coming in like us. He kept us waiting a while. And I remember we cooling our heels in a room that had photographs, small photographs of all the state legislators since 1912. The one stuck in my mind was Jesus H. Christ.
Jesus.
Probably Jesus. Anyhow, we were eventually called into the presence where David King had arranged various state officials, including one guy who, he was the head of the fish and game thing for the state. The state land commissioner was there. There were a bunch of these people who should have been informed, it's appropriate. And I forget which one it was. I think it was the fish and game man. He was obviously drunk. But he's one of these guys who could be drunk and still track very well. And he wound up making a difference in this thing. Because what happened, King calls the meeting. And I remember he's a kid. Mm-hmm. And